counsel. Last case for argument is Nostalgia Network versus Lockwood. Mr. Dragutinovich.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Zoran Dragutinovich. I represent defendant Bonnie Lockwood. This is a case in which the district court entered summary judgment under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act on behalf of the plaintiff, Nostalgia Network, and against the defendant. The trial court's finding, based on its finding that there was fraud in law under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, and based essentially on the finding that the debtor who transferred funds to the defendant, Merrick Scott Rail, did not receive reasonably equivalent value for those transfers. We submit that the district court was wrong, that in fact, if the money is followed from Mr. Rail through Ms. Lockwood, that the funds were used to pay antecedent and subsisting obligations of Mr. Rail.
But she had the power over it, though. She could have done what she wanted with that money, right? She just happened to still like him well.
Well, that is correct, but the relationship was one where she assisted him. He's a lawyer, and she assisted him in his legal practice, paid his bills, and this was more or less a convenience for them for him to do that. They paid residential and office rent, they paid taxes, utilities. There was a large chunk of money came into this account as a result of a settlement of a lawsuit that Mr. Rail brought against the town of Cicero for back fees that he was owed, and approximately $218,000 was deposited in that account in July of 1999. That money almost immediately went out to pay the lawyers, investigators, and others who assisted in this litigation.
Went out over her signature, right?
No. Well, some of them were under, both Mr. Rail and Ms. Lockwood had signatory powers over this account. And some of the checks she wrote and others he did. But the point here is that the court merely looked at the consideration.
Well,
that
why did he do this? Why did he have his money in her account?
Well, it was actually his account, Your Honor. It was his. He's had that account for many, many years. For a time, that account was placed in joint tenancy, and at some point subsequent, and in fact, that was the time period that plaintiff used to define the fraudulent transfer. It was placed in her name.
Why?
I can't answer that, Judge. But the bottom line is that the money retained his. He retained control over it. It was not a secret.
To put money in someone else's account to pay your own expenses, it does have a fraudulent air to it, doesn't it? Especially if you're being pursued by a bunch of creditors.
Well, the fact of the matter is that may or may not be true, but this account was, there were checks drawn. It wasn't like it was placed in an account offshore that was under somebody else's name or whatever. There were checks drawn on this account to pay legitimate creditors. And in fact, it was Nostalgia very quickly discovered this account as part of their citation to discover assets. They were not delayed particularly long in discovering that in any event. But as I say, the bottom line here is that the analysis, the district court should have focused on what happened to the money. It should have followed the money into the hands of these third parties who did, in fact, provide value to Mr. Rail and who were compensated for that. Had that account remained in his name, there was no way that Nostalgia could have reached those funds because he did receive reasonably equivalent value for all of the payments, virtually all of the payments that were made from that account. What this has done is essentially it's created an anomaly. The Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act is meant to protect creditors from unscrupulous debtors who seek to hide their assets, and it essentially tries to level the playing field. Here, nostalgia is actually placed in a better position than it would have been had the transfers not taken place. In fact, it's achieving indirectly what it couldn't achieve directly. It could not go directly against those third parties to collect the funds paid to them. In fact, in the citation proceedings, Nostalgia did locate there's an investigator and lawyers, and they were questioned by Nostalgia, but the money they received was protected by the Fraudulent Transfer Act because.
Are you saying that when he put the account in her name and then transferred money into it, she was obliged to pay his living expenses?
No, she wasn't obliged. They were.
So she did not actually provide any consideration for this transfer.
She personally did that.
Now, your opponent says this argument you're making that there was value received, albeit somewhat indirectly. Your opponent says you didn't argue this to the district judge.
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't raised in the summary judgment papers. However, we did raise the argument in our motion for relief from judgment, which we did file subsequently. It was raised and argued at that
point. Post-judgment after the district court granted judgment.
Yes. And moreover, these facts appear on the face of Nostalgia's summary judgment submissions. They're all over the papers. The checks that form the basis for this are all among the exhibits that Nostalgia marshaled in support. And the checks clearly show that they went to Meritex, they went to landlord, to lawyers, and so forth. Very, very clearly show where the money trail led. As I say, the court stopped its analysis at Bonnie Lockwood. If you take Bonnie Lockwood out of the equation, there's no cause of action because there's no way that Nostalgia can go after those third parties, as I say, because those third parties did provide reasonably equivalent value to Rail for the payments that he made.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sherlock?
May it please the Court. Your Honors, this is a very simple fraudulent transfer action in which the debtor, Merrick Scott Rail, transferred more than $300,000 to his girlfriend in order to...
But your argument is somewhat technical because you're not arguing fraud in fact, just as fraud in law, and it's true that the transfer to her was without consideration, so it fits the mold of fraud in fact, but if that money was used for his expenses, that didn't hurt the creditors, did it?
Well, it did, Your Honor, and we did argue both fraud in fact and fraud in law.
But the judge didn't reach the fraud in fact.
That's correct, Your Honor. We were prejudiced, Your Honor, because from the time that we found out about the account, we would have found out about it sooner had it been in Mr. Rail's name. We issued a citation to him in September, I believe, of 99, and we took his deposition, and only in connection with that deposition did we find out that Lockwood had an account that had his money in it, or that was money that was fraudulently transferred to him, and therefore we went out and we sought Miss Lockwood, and we lost out on over a month's worth of transfers out of the account. We weren't able to seize that when we initiated the Indiana interim proceeding. In addition, what the defendant's lawyer never has raised is that Lockwood took steps to further the fraud and transferred $7,000 out of that account.
Right, but now you're moving over from the fraud in law to fraud in fact. Were you advancing as an alternative ground that we should determine there was fraud in fact?
If Your Honors are inclined to do that, yes, we would.
No, but I did you in your brief.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And Your Honor, with respect to the fraud in the law, the Uniform Fraud on Transfer Act is real clear. It says if a debtor transfers an asset at the time when he's insolvent or she's insolvent, when there's a claim outstanding, and the person, the immediate transferee, does not give reasonably equivalent value, it's a fraudulent transfer to those credit to the debtor's creditors. And that's the precise situation here. And Mr. Dragutinovich and Ms. Lockwood's but-for argument proves the point. But for that transfer, it wouldn't have been a fraudulent transfer. But the fact of the matter is, the very simple fact of the matter, is that he did transfer it to Lockwood, and he did it under very suspicious circumstances on the very same day that another judgment creditor perfected an $80,000 judgment against Mr. Rail. That's the same day that he put title in the of the account into Ms. Lockwood's name. And also what's very clear, Your Honor, is the testimony in this case is that Ms. Lockwood says he gave it all of the money to me. He wanted me to have it all. Mr. Rail testifies, I didn't want to be burdened with this money. I wanted her to have it. And it's between the two of them, he couldn't come back to her and say, I want it back. As to his creditors, we could. And the fact that she chose to pay his debt is irrelevant. They could have broken up a week after she accepted the transfer and never given the money back to him. So I think that hopefully that answers your question, mm-hmm. Your Honor. And with respect to the another argument I'd like to raise is the fact that they did not raise this on appeal on the summary judgment motions below. The first time they raised this was in a reply brief in a Rule 60B motion whose focus had nothing to do with re-arguing the merits. If they wanted to raise this issue, it's because they forgot in the initial briefing, they should have filed a motion to reconsider before final judgment was entered or before they filed their notice of appeal, and they didn't. And I believe the case law is pretty clear, Your Honor, that they've waived that. They can't argue that above. They do make the other arguments about ratio to account and collateral estoppel, but it appears that they've abandoned that in their reply brief and didn't raise it here. And unless I'll rest on my submissions with respect to that, unless the court has some questions with respect to those issues.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Sterling.
Thank you.
Mr. Dragutinovich, how much do you have? 3 minutes?
Thank you. Very briefly, I want to address the contention that counsel made about nostalgias being prejudiced by their late discovery of this account and that they were thereby deprived of a month's worth of transfer. And in fact, they weren't. And as I indicated earlier, the bulk of this money was a payment from the town of Cicero, which came in to this account in July, and most of that money was already dispersed by the end of August. The citation occurred on September 10th, 1999, which was after most of this money was already out. There was a subsequent transfer into that account of approximately $29,000, most of which was still in there and was frozen in that account and ultimately awarded to Nostalgia as part of the proceeding in Indiana. So they really were not, if it could be quantified, it's probably a very, very little bit of money in that account that they would have, could not have touched because of the fact that they discovered this late, as they said. In terms of the fraud in fact and fraud in law analyses, both of these types of claims do turn on the element of a reasonably equivalent value to the debtor, whether the debtor received reasonably equivalent value for the transfers. So that to the extent that this court finds that as to the fraud in law claim, there was reason that Mr. Rail did receive reasonably equivalent value, I should also find that in terms of Nostalgia's fraud and fact claim, this is also the case. For those reasons, we ask this court to refer.
Okay. Thank you very much, both counsel, and the court will be in recess until sometime in the future.